So how long are these interviews? How long do you do a podcast? How long?
So you don't listen to these?
I haven't been on one yet, man. I'm so sad.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Pre-Accident Podcast. I'm your host, Todd Conklin. How'd that sound? Pretty impressive. You into it? Are you totally thinking I sound like an amazing, amazing guy? Because that is my goal always. Today is a great day to listen to a podcast. I'm glad you're listening, whatever you're doing. If you're riding your bike, no, it's too cold probably. If you're sitting in the office, that's good. If you're riding on a plane, well, you're probably next to me. Don't poke me or give me the look. I've been getting the look a lot lately. Whatever you're doing, today's a good day to do it. It is nearly time for the season of office parties to begin. A whole new set of challenges, manipulating, managing, understanding, handling office politics at a social level is always interesting at every turn. It never stops being kind of interesting, and it will continue to be this time as well. My favorite holiday is Thanksgiving. I bet you can figure out why. But I like the idea of just being thankful. It's an agenda-free holiday that allows us to be grateful, and there is nothing wrong with that at all. So it's been fun. Lots of travel this year for me, and it's coming to a close. December should slow down a bit, just a couple gigs. I'm busy, but I think we're all kind of busy. That's how it works. January looks promising. I'm really looking forward to next year. Lots of people lining up for the podcast next year, too. Hope your life's going well, and I hope you have a great holiday. That's important to me as well. Today's podcast is David Marks. Do you know that name? If you don't, you should. Many years ago, he wrote a book called Whack-A-Mole. It came out really early, kind of a cute little book, really interesting, and it talked about the challenge we have organizationally in our reactive posture we take to managing failure. So when something happens, we hammer it like we whack-a-mole after the bad thing has happened and wait for the next thing to happen someplace else, and we play the game whack-a-mole. It's a big industrial game, whack-a-mole. And David and I have been friends for many, many years, and we do have a good friendship. We have a kind of friendship where you can argue and just be fine with it, and I like that about him a lot. And you'll tell that we're friends in this podcast because you'll tell we're going to argue in this podcast. We argue over a lot of things. One is free will. He's an attorney and an engineer who's really focused on justice, workplace, just culture, and he's focused a lot on healthcare by choice. I mean, he's made a decision to go into a field where he thinks the need is greatest, and I got to tell him, I mean, he's right on target, and I'm super proud of what he does, and I'm super proud of how he does it. He's a good guy. He's a great writer, and he's got a new book coming up, and he contacted me, and I said, I'd love to have you on the podcast, and as you can tell by the beginning of this, he had no idea the podcast really – he didn't. I'm not sure he knows what a podcast is, kind of. But we got through all that, and then we had a great discussion about this new book, which is called Dave Subs, which drops probably just before this podcast comes out, and it looks to be promising. I've not seen it or read it yet, but I will, and I'll be anxious to see what you think about it as well. Mostly, however, what we're going to talk about is kind of how accountability plays into this story, because what Dave and his organization, which is Outcome Ingenuity, is the name of the company, and many of you are going to be familiar with it, they do a lot of work around accountability, which is why you can have an argument about free will and words like risky choices, because accountability, at least in Dave's world, is the workers sort of the workers' capacity to not make risky decisions. And of course, you know that I'm going to come to that from the direction that says, how do you know a decision is risky until after it has consequence? Because most operational decisions aren't really decisions. They're not choices. They're more responses to stimuli within the system. And those are just different worldviews. Neither are probably wrong. One of them is more correct. You can pick which one you think it is. Either way, open the mind up and listen carefully to what David says, because I think you'll find him to be very interesting, and he's certainly funny. He's always got stuff going on. This will not be the last time David Marks is on this podcast. In fact, sadly, it's the first time. I should have been doing this way earlier, but I promise you I'll do more of them. And you'll see why when you hear it, because, it's a fun podcast. It's a great, jaunty combination of information back and forth between one another, and that's what it's all about. Thanks for listening. The numbers are huge, and that's great. I'm mostly just glad people are listening, because mostly what I want the world to be is a better place. And to do that, I think I ought to take a few minutes and just think about what I'm grateful for. And partially, I'm grateful for the fact that the timing seems right across the world to have this discussion about shifting the focus of the way we look at safety. Safety one, safety two, new view, old view, high reliability, whatever you want to call it. Ultimately, what we're getting at is we've got to change the way we look at and understand how we view workers. Are workers a problem to be fixed, or are workers a solution to be harnessed? And you'll hear lots of that. And I hear it lots. And I have these conversations with you. And I want to thank you for it, because it's really fun. But maybe the best way to say thank you is for me to shut up and actually bring David on, and you can hear what David has to say. So without any further ado, this, my friends, is the great David Marks.
Okay, well, cool. So I'm ready whenever you are.
We're going, baby. So tell me everything. Tell me what you're up to now. What are you thinking now? And then
But you're editing these things, right?
Yeah, so what I do is I'll edit it so it's around 30 minutes for sure. And then anything that's like if Skype goes out on us, or if you say fart, or if something weird happens, I'll cut it out. Like, I am expecting UPS to come at any moment, so I'm almost positive they'll come during our podcast, because why wouldn't they? So when that happens, I'll edit that out as well. But yeah, anything. Dead out. I don't really send them out to you for approval. And the reason I don't is not because I'm a jerk or anything, or an artiste. It's because I'm just not that organized. I just can't get crap together. So, because I do try to spend the least amount of time as possible. So that's what I go for. So
I get it. Well, let's do it.
On it, baby. We are on it. So tell us anything you want to tell us to start with. I'm you about can't say anything wrong, Mr. Marks. There's nothing wrong to be said.
Yeah, well, I got to tell you, so what we're doing, I'm up here in Brooklyn now, but we just released, actually, in November 16th, it's Amazon Start Shipping, but it's a new book that we just published. It's called Dave Subs, and it's a tale about the workplace and accountability in the workplace, and it's, you know, 300-page book, and I've never written a book that's like a novel, but this one reads as a novel, and it's about a sub shop here in New Jersey, actually. And it's about, has a big significant event, a sentinel kind of event at the beginning where we actually give a gluten-filled sub to somebody who needed gluten-free. And of course, there's a lawsuit. But ultimately, the owner of the sub shop, and he owns six of these sub shops, he decides, look, it was a mistake on the part of my employee. And he decides against what everybody's telling him to do, his advisors, the press. He decides not to fire this employee. He says, look, I'm not going to fire an employee simply for making a mistake. And then the rest of the story, actually, you watch Milo. His name is Milo. He is the manager of that one store. He spends the next year sort of figuring out what accountability is going to look like. And because even though he said we're not going to fire somebody for making a mistake, he had some, you know, he's had these what we call sub-artisans, but really do some squirrely things. And he has to sort of figure out, okay, where do we draw these sort of lines, and where do we work through accountability in the workplace? So it's a story about workplace accountability, and it's meant to, it's a business book, but it's meant to read like a novel, but ultimately challenge a manager to say, look, because managers never really had this kind of training. It's like, how do you sort of differentiate and the different sort of levels or ideas by which employees make decisions, and how do you steer them in the right way, and ultimately sort of how do you judge their conduct as a manager, and how do you hold them accountable? And that's what the book's about.
Why do you think accountability is such a bugaboo? And I know I don't want to scare you with my technical use of the term bugaboo, but this is a giant – I mean, I spend a lot of my career in fact, I was on a phone call before we're talking today with a manager talking about accountability. Why are people so freaked out about accountability?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because everybody comes to like a class and says, you know, how do we design better systems around our employees? And it, you know, we're just from that system space. But if you look like at the VA, President Obama came out and said, look, we need a culture of accountability. And I think it's that issue that there's two pieces to the puzzle. There's the big system piece, but often when we're talking in the press about accountability, we're seeing things like, you know, football players deflating balls, and you know, they aren't really part of the system design, but they're just what human beings do, where they get themselves. So I think we see even organizations that start to drift into risky and riskier places. And accountability just seems to be the word that we're using now to describe, you know, that ultimately, Todd, I think, and you and I both know, it's that two pieces. You do the best you can to build the system around them, but we ultimately there's some duties and responsibilities that the individuals in the system have as human components to make the system work.
How do you define accountability? What's David Marks's definition for accountability?
You know what? That's a good question, because I when we teach like a just culture course, we say, look, this isn't about blame. Blame is a lunchtime activity of, you know, who are you going to blame for this bad event that just occurred? Accountability is just saying, as human components, when we don't live up to our expectations that are set, you know, accountability is just the other side of expectation. If I don't live up to expectation, how am I held to account for not living up to those expectations? So what accountability.
What if I took the word accountability and told you that I think there's two ways to see it? I'd be really curious what you had to say. That there's accountability in the backwards looking notion, which is kind of what you're referring to, that we look at accountability after a worker makes a risky choice. Oh my God, my brain cramped when I said the word risky choice. Right. And there's also then forward-looking accountability. And in fact, if you ask me to define accountability, I might tell you that I would look at the phrase, you can count on me. And if you can count, if you can count on me to do the right thing, if you've done your job, boss man, of making the best sub sandwich shop system that you can possibly make, it's going to always be running degraded, and it won't be sufficient because it's a system. But if you've done the best job possible in giving me a good system, you can count on me to move into that system and make good choices, non-risky. Oh, another cramp, non-risky choices. That's more of a forward-looking understanding of accountability. And I should probably own that a little by telling you that I've been fixated on our need to see workers as a problem to be fixed, as opposed to seeing workers as a resource to be harnessed. The ball is in your court now.
Yes. Well, and that's very nice, but you know,
ouch.
That's very nice, but it's perhaps the lawyer inside of me, because that goes back to sort of sense of duty. And if we have a sense of duty, you know, human beings, we're going to do the right thing. And you know, you can say, you know, can you count on me? And the answer is, well, we'll see, right? I mean, ultimately, you're looking at it after the fact and saying, okay, you know, we designed that good system. How has the employee performed within this system? But, and if they're not performing the way we want them, can we redesign the system to steer them in the direction that we want? But
wouldn't you agree that the employee's the least reliable part of that system? I mean, the employee's not. I'll never have machine reliability. I'm not a reliable employee. I'm a good employee, and I'm as reliable as I can be. But I'm still, you know, I'm still going to be overcome with things like efficiencies, and you know, I'd like to get out early because it's my birthday, and there's beer to be had by the beer giving out people.
Yeah. Or you're a Wall Street banker that says, look, you know, we can make riskier and riskier loans here and, you know, put money in our pocket, yet we're getting increasingly closer and closer to, you know, a meltdown of the financial system. So it's just what human beings do. And that, you know, the human error, I just got to give up on. It's all sort of system design. You know, the human error piece is we're going to make mistakes. We're inescapably fallible. And you and I have talked about sort of the highly culpable side where, you know, I'm knowingly putting other people in harm's way. I'm gambling, right. Sort of right. Like the drunk driving. Right. That middle ground that you and I have had that conversation where, you know, I use the word at-risk behavior, and when I use the word at-risk choice, you grimace, and I've had to face that. You have been quite an inspiration, and in sort of, you know, what I shift to at-risk choice, and actually Milo in the book settles in on at-risk behavior. But you know, actually, one of the things I've been doing in the book, we pull in Daniel Kahneman's work around thinking fast and slow, where he talks about the system one, system two brain, the conscious brain, and I've been making conscious choices, or that subconscious level where Daniel Kahneman says it's the hero of his book, where all this stuff that we do subconsciously, all these things that become habit, that you're going to say, look, they're not choices at that point. They're just like what I do.
Right.
But they might be risky. Your system one brain's engaging in these risky choices because we human beings just drift, and now our conscious brain's on something totally different. And I think the culture piece is that work. I think it's funny because we hear the word accountability. Accountability, whenever we hear it in the press, has to do with probably much more culpable behavior when we talk about accountability in the banking industry, or you know, when you're watching a presidential campaign, they're talking about people are saying I want more than my share and know that they're doing it. But from a culture perspective, work on safety in an organization, it's not so much that group of people. It's the people that well-meaning employees that get caught up in drifting away from what is the best thing to do to protect a particular value like safety, but just because they just, you know, there's always that interest of saying, how can I be more efficient? You know, even if the system's not pushing them there, human beings tend to find ways to be much more efficient at what they do. You know, okay. I moved here to New York City, and watching people cross the street in New York City, it's just like nobody follows the rules. They got their earbuds in, they're staring at their phones, crossing on the red. We kill like 250 people a year on the streets of New York, and if you talk to anybody on the street, they're like, I don't see it. I'm just doing what I do.
Right, right, and that's interesting to me because you look at that example actually is one we should probably pull a string on. You know, how do we make that better? Well, is softer cars an option?
Yeah, and that's right. We do everything. And whenever I talk about that, like in a class, everybody's like, oh, I got all these great system solutions. Like, let's elevate the people so they're at a different level than the cars. But the practical reality of it is we're not going to get there on the streets of a city with 8 million people. The other piece of that is to say, let's get to a place where we follow the rules. And I was just out in Vancouver a week ago watching and walking the streets of Vancouver. Everybody dutifully stops at the red sign and stops until it turns green. And it's just a wildly different culture. The big question for us in the safety space is, how did Vancouver get there, or how did they stay there, and how did New York get where they got? And ultimately, how do you shift the culture so that ultimately you can take the benefit of the system that you've designed? Because here in New York, we've got the signs, but nobody follows them. It's sort of every person for themselves. You know, if it looks good to me, I'll go across. The problem there is people misperceive, they misinterpret, and all of a sudden one of those folks crossing the red gets, you know, taken out by a car.
Oh, sure. Exaggerate their capability. You know, I can make it. I never get hit before. I can easily get away. I can jump over. I can do all those amazing superhero skills to make it better.
And, yeah, and we know if they saw people getting hit at a pretty good clip, wouldn't take much. You know, one a week, you'd be sitting there stopping at the red. The problem is we as humans we're getting so reliable in so many places that you can deviate from the procedure, so to speak, on the streets and never see anybody hit in your lifetime here in New York. So it's like, look, I don't see a downside, but I get to work faster. I get to multitask. I get to listen to podcasts on my way to work as I'm walking the streets of New York.
That's what I want to hear. That's what I want to hear.
That's right. Yeah, so you're just contributing to this stuff. Anyway, so yeah, but your issue, I backed off. It's not at-risk choice. We kept a sort of at-risk behavior. All the conversations you and I have had about you know, that place where we're doing things just out of habit, out of as the norm. You know, we still tag it sort of at-risk behavior, but it's really struggling with, you know, how do people get caught up in those moments or in that habit? And we see it as outsiders as risky. Now, how do we steer them back onto the safe place? And as we talk about building like non-punitive cultures, where and a lot of people perceive that to be like, okay, nobody's held accountable. It's like, how do we hold them accountable? And ultimately, how do you get that person to say to you, Todd, you can count on me? And counting on them is to do things that might not seem natural to them now because they're into this risky place. You can't turn to a person in New York City and say, hey, do you know about Mayor de Blasio's Vision Zero? Because we want to get to zero accidents and zero deaths here in New York. And if you turned to them and said that to them, you know, I think they would, you know, they might be likely to pull out a gun and shoot you. It's nobody wants to hear that. So it's,
which would completely take you away from Vision Zero.
Yeah, well, that's right, because we'd have a death. That's right. Yeah. So, yeah, we'd have 250 people shot rather than 250 people dying from cars. Exactly.
So what do we do with this? I mean, where are we going? So let me ask two questions. I got two big ones. I probably have more, but I have two that are on my mind. One is, why novel form? Why did you choose narrative to talk about this? Is it more interesting to write? Is it more interesting to read? Is it a better way to shift thinking around accountability?
Yeah, probably because I'm tired of reading business books. But no, I think that we're halfway through the book, actually. We've written more than half of it. And we just decided it sounded too much like a professor. And we didn't want to speak at the people reading the book. We wanted the people reading the book to go through the journey that Milo goes through. Because, you know, accountability is an emotional thing. It's not simply, do I have an algorithm? Can I walk through some algorithm? It's not science. It's really, there's a whole huge emotional component to it. And even the notion of a person that makes a mistake that causes harm, we're sort of hardwired seemingly that bad outcomes must be caused by bad people. And how do you get people away from that? And we thought the novel offered the best opportunity for the reader to feel some compassion, empathy for the manager who's struggling through this. So it was tough for me as the author because I have him get it wrong, or at least in my view, wrong early on in the book, but he has to learn his lessons as he goes through it. And you can't do that stuff writing from a, you know, more professorial view because, you know, you can't get it wrong and then later correct. So you could in the novel form. And frankly, you know, there's so many business books out there and you know, so many are so dry. We just thought, well, let's try this. And, you know, it's the first time in my life I ever had to write a sentence that, you know, said Milo at the end. That's totally foreign to me, but it was quite a fun exercise to go through.
And I do think it's probably more fun to read. How's this translating to your work in medicine? Because I think of you almost every day because you're out there fighting, really, I think, the important fight. I think the work I do with construction or oil and gas or transportation, that's important work. But medicine is such a challenge because it's such a problem and nobody's willing to spend a penny to actually make it better.
Yeah, that's, you know, it's interesting for us as a team. I think our whole organization, it's, you know, the most recent number out of National Patient Safety Foundation is that we lose 440,000 lives a year due to medical errors and hospital acquired infection in our nation's hospitals. So it's a pretty big number. And how do we address this? And we spend a lot of time helping healthcare organizations on the system design side and on the culture side. And so, you know, it's 80% of our work. The book is interesting because to do a book about a sub shop in New Jersey, we were gambling a little bit that a chief medical officer would find any similarities between, a 10,000 person healthcare organization and a sub shop with five employees. Hopefully the more enlightened ones would say, look, the issues are the same because those artisans are, you know, that work in the sub shop are no different than a nurse or a pharmacist or a doctor in a hospital because we're really talking about the same human being. So, the work that we're doing is we're doing a lot of work in healthcare, but, you know, one of the things that we did with the book, I should have said, is, you know, one of our targets is the 250,000 members of Society of Human Resource Management. We want to go after, our goal now is to say, how do we really get every employer, and you're doing a lot of this work, Todd, because you're doing work in, you're doing work in the chemical industry, you're doing work in manufacturing. How do we get every employer in the U.S. To embrace these kinds of ideas? If you work at Chipotle or you work at a bank, The ideas that we have been working for the last 20 years, I think, are equally applicable. And if we're going to really shift culture beyond an organization to a society, that's our goal. We had to go after the 250,000 members that are sort of in that sort of HR space around the world, saying, how do we steer this group of employees that we have? So one of our targets is to use that book to reach out to them and say, hey, maybe workplace accountability should look a little different.
And what makes you guys think, and you could be right, I certainly have no hidden agenda on this, but what makes you think HR is the right level? I can't figure out, in my mind, where the right level is.
Yeah, that's true. You know, I think that it's funny because the safety space that we have been in, I think safety practitioners get this. They totally get it. You know, the FAA says you got to go down this path. Joint Commission says you got to go down this path of high reliability. And so I think they get it. I think the HR folks have sat on the side and said, look, we just write rules to defend the organization. We don't really write rules for our employees. And I think this is the place to start pushing them as well. But ultimately, this is a leadership issue. This is top down in many organizations to say, how is the leader going to lead? How are they going to role model? How are they going to mentor? How are they going to hold people accountable when bad things do happen? And so I think ultimately it is the leadership level. But I think, I think we've done well in the safety space. I think these ideas, everything that I can only imagine what's across all of your podcasts, but the things that we're talking about in this space are now being adopted. The safety space, I think, has moved on. I think now for us, the next one is say, okay, let's go after HR space. Well, we always go after leadership and say, how are we going to get leadership steered in this way as well?
Well, and I think you're right. I think HR is actually a really great target. It's a good place to go. And I think leaders, at least in my mind, and I could be a little naive, leaders are very willing to hear this message. One of the things I'm learning is that we've not done a terribly good job helping leaders hear this message. We haven't done a good job. When leaders push back around risky choices and accountability, I've had to teach myself not to get defensive, but in fact to get instructive. Because what it means is that we haven't done a good job giving them the right information. The other thing, Dave, I think we do is we ask leaders to be different, but we don't really build systems, the structure around leadership that causes them to be different. And I'm really interested in what you think about that.
Yeah. Well, and I think part of that too is, you know, where do they get their information? And if you go inside an organization and you say, okay, I'm the employee safety person, or I'm the patient safety person, they sort of own that value of safety and say, what are we doing relative to that particular outcome? But when you talk about accountability, who owns accountability? Workforce accountability, or in the HR space, and what they will say, traditionally will say, is look, an employee breaches, particularly like a safety rule, employee breaches a safety rule, maybe this isn't the right place for them. Whether that was a human error or a reckless choice doesn't sort of matter to the HR professional. It's just the fact that we breach and we're less than perfect. So I think we have, they're not hearing the right voices.
What?
And I think
we breach and we oversimplify. So the workers breach, yep, and the leaders oversimplify. The rule's clear. They should have followed it. They didn't. Okay, case closed. Right. And the workers out there, you know, and kind of Kahneman's thinking fast and slow side of the house, thinking, crap, I didn't even think of that as a choice. Like, I just got off the phone. Big argument with a guy over linemen using knives instead of wire strippers.
Right.
So in my experience, when I talked to a lineman who cut his hand, he said to me, I always use a knife. I've always used a knife. For 25 years, we use knives. He said, I was using the knife even before I thought about the fact that I wasn't using the knife. When I cut my hand, I would have completely used the stripper, but my habit was to use the knife. Now, that gets right back into what we always argue about, right? Risky choice versus sort of system-influenced behavior, right, culturally influenced behavior. I think that's really that changes how we talk about accountability to leaders. I mean, that is a different story. That's a much more nuanced story. That's a much harder story to tell. That's a narrative and not a chart, right? I mean, that's a much different conversation to have with leaders. And you're good at this. I mean, you've been doing this a long time. You're the man. How are you doing it? How you well, are you the man?
Well, you go into a hospital. This is what's wild, particularly for anybody that is on your podcast. It's not on healthcare. It's 100,000 people a year that will lose their lives to the hospital acquired infection. And the number one thing that you can do is wash your hands for the CDC standards. And if you were working at NASA or an industrial environment, if you had to guess what the compliance rate, you'd say, well, it's got to be at 99%. But when you got hospitals still teetering at 70% compliance rate, and that's why, so I put back to Utah, that 30%, we're going to say, look, there's a space where they're going to make a mistake where if you just ask them after the fact, would you have washed your hands? They're going to say, absolutely, I would have. So maybe that's 2%. You know, it's not going to be 30% where it's like, I just simply forgot. That there's that 28% between where I'm doing it and in my air where I'm not washing my hands the way I should. But it's now just that habit space. And CEOs, I can tell you, just about every CEO of a hospital in the U.S. is struggling with, well, what do I do? Because my employees aren't washing hands the way they need to wash their hands. The doctors aren't role modeling it. The patients that come or the family members aren't role modeling it. It's pretty easy just to get caught up in the culture that of all the things I got to do, this isn't the top of my list. And ultimately, you know, how do you steer the employees that way? And what place does accountability play?
But isn't that crosswalks in Vancouver?
Well, yeah.
Isn't it crosswalks in New York, depending whether you want to take an appreciative or a non-appreciative view of that.
Well, that's right. And when I talk to leaders in the healthcare, I say, look, the issue you got is Vancouver versus New York. And they're thinking, well, that's on the street. It's like, well, that person on the street is your doctor or nurse who's about ready to come in to your hospital.
So what hospitals have good hand washing? Where is this done well?
And this is anecdotally, but we have hospitals in the high 90s. But you know, one of the places done well is where physicians lead, where the chief medical officer, the chief of the services say, we're going to wash our hands and we're going to call it out when we see others not washing their hands. We're going to turn to a nurse or a pharmacist and say, I need you to wash your hands. And actually, one thing healthcare is doing is it's embracing the healthcare version of career resource management or what the DOD created a program called Team Steps. But it's creating that notion that when I got to try to do the right thing, you can count on me, but I'm also going to challenge my colleague, my peer, to do the right thing. If I see them not washing their hands, I got to call it out. And, to some extent, doctors have sort of gotten a pass historically. It's like, okay, well, we'll do this and doctors will do their own thing. But when you have doctors who are, in the authority grade and at the top of the picture, if they start to role model and people can see that and they're challenging, you start to see organizations shift. So some of the best I've seen is where you have leadership really saying, look, I'm going to do this and you can hold me accountable. And also I'm going to challenge those who I see not doing it.
What are you thinking about next? You got the book going, Dave Subs.
Well, yeah. Well, be short of retirement.
or death. Let's skip death and retirement. Let's set those aside.
Yeah, something in the fire. But actually, one thing we're doing this next year, we're going to join. I guess you'd say join the high reliability craze. But we're in the works of building a course. Actually, we call highly reliable outcomes. We're going to use the HRO terminology, but we'll call it highly reliable outcomes because. Maybe it's another podcast, but I don't believe in the notion of highly reliable organizations. In the sense that you could be an organization and have great outcomes in one area and terrible outcomes in another area. Aviation being a good example of that because it's extremely reliable if you're a passenger, but if you're an employee, it's a pretty dangerous place to work. So there's no sort of secret. If you got the secret sauce, it doesn't mean I'm going to be great at everything. So the HRO course, Highly Reliable Outcomes, is just really how do we produce highly reliable outcomes? Because where we're at, we've been teaching learning systems. We've been teaching event investigation, root cause analysis. We've been teaching the justice piece. But But the things that you do, I'm sure, is you know, how do you teach managers how to design good systems, and how do you teach them how to steer those inescapably fallible human beings with free will that work for them.
Oh, nice. Nice on the free will. Very nice. Thank you.
Yes,
It's not true, but thank you. Workers don't have free will. I mean, this is a complete other podcast, but touche.
So, Todd, human beings have free will. And this is the place, yeah, you're right. It's the intro to another podcast. But I think that person who says, I'm going to be on my phone, staring at my phone with my earbuds in, crossing on the red, does that at a large level through their free will. And the issue is, once it becomes habit, their conscious mind can be on totally different things. But even us, we moved here, we were aghast at how bad people were when they crossed the streets. But, you know, it didn't take us but 3 months, and we were just like every other New Yorker.
Sure.
So and I can even conceptually say, it's like, this is outrageous, and I do. You know, I'll have my days, it's like, I can't believe what we're doing here. And then 10 minutes later, I'm doing it just like everybody else.
What a fun thing to talk to. We've got to do more of these, can we?
Oh, we sure can. Yeah, we'll see what kind of response you get from this one, but I really appreciate this.
So, and the book's out now. They can get it now?
Yeah, you can go on Amazon and pre-order it. It ships on November 16th. The books are there. That's the release date. So, we look forward to anybody that happens to read it. Any feedback you give us, we'd love it. So, Todd, I'll tell you what. I'm going to go through, 10 of your podcasts. If you get a chance to read my book, I'll even send one to you.
You send one to me, and I'll read it. I got eyes. I'm ready to use them.
Well, I'm pretty sure what's going to happen is you're going to mark it up, and then you're going to say, hey, we can do a podcast on my critique of your book. So
maybe
that's where we'll be.
Maybe that's fun. Thank you for your time, my friend.
All right. It's been my pleasure. And we'll find time to catch up.
What do you think? Told you. He's very interesting. He's super smart. So got that going for him, and very successful. He's done a lot of heavy lifting in the world. As much fun as I want to make of everybody, and I always kind of want to make fun of everybody, what the work David's done, I think, has been very meaningful, because he's really built and reinforced a new vocabulary into lots of the workforce. And lots of you know him and love him and have worked with him. And if you didn't, it's a really good chance to get to meet him. And he'll be on again, because we're not done talking about free will, predeterminism, choice. It's a little bit, in my mind, a little bit too seductively unambiguous. But remember, he's an attorney engineer, actually engineer attorney. That'd be the order he took it in. So he's going to have a worldview that comes from that side of the house. And that, my friends, is why David's amazing. Because that worldview, I think, is an important worldview for us to hear and to think about. And there you have it. One more podcast in the bag. Thanks for listening. I'm so glad you're a part of this. It's always great to have you on board. Until then, learn something new every day, have some fun, and for goodness sakes, be safe.
What kind of hippie bullshit is this?